This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Cliff Sims was a member of the Trump communications team, first during the presidential campaign, then during the first 15 months of the administration. Sims describes the White House power structure not as a flowchart, but as a solar system, with President Trump as the sun and everyone else in orbits at varying distances. Sims says he was pretty close. More of a Mercury than a Jupiter. So close that regardless of his job title, he was a fly on the wall for meetings with heads of state, the cabinet, kings, princes, and captains of industry. He says he heard the president scream at House Speaker Paul Ryan. He saw former press secretary Sean Spicer steal a fridge. He helped the president draft a literal enemies list. And he witnessed the resignations of Spicer, Reince Priebus, Anthony Scaramucci, Steve Bannon, and eventually himself. Joining us from NPR in New York is Cliff Sims, former special assistant to the president and director of White House message strategy. His new book is called Team of Vipers, My 500 Extraordinary Days in the Trump White House. Cliff, welcome to 1A.
Oh, thanks for having me. I feel like I'm back in Alabama. You know, before I got into Trump world, I actually hosted a radio show down there, so I feel like I'm back in the saddle today.
I assure you this will be slightly different from Alabama, but I'm glad the environs feel familiar, and hopefully you're familiar with taking questions and comments, because there will be quite a few of them. Let's start with the title, Team of Vipers. In the author's note, you write, Lincoln famously had his team of rivals. Trump had his team of vipers. What do you mean by vipers?
Well, you know, I love that Doris Kearns Goodwin book. And, you know, reading up on the Lincoln administration, there were certainly a lot of issues there. And they really were a team of rivals. But ultimately, what they were able to do was come together behind their commander in chief and subordinate their views to his, even when it was hard. And what I noticed in the Trump administration is that that basically never happened, that you have this group of people who come from various backgrounds, some of them political, some not, some from the business world, some with no experience in politics. You put them all in a room together, and there's just a power struggle that basically took place from day one in there, and very self-serving and selfish a lot of times, and undermining the president, undermining each other. Most of my experience with teams, I played basketball in college, and I remember, we had tough times in teams. It kind of brought us together. It was kind of an us against the world bunker type mentality. That never quite happened in the Trump White House. And so while we were, fighting whatever external forces may be out there, we were also spent a lot of time fighting amongst ourselves. And so that's where you get your team of vipers.
It sounds like you're describing a group of people who are poisonous and are not above biting one another.
Well, there's no doubt. And one of the things I try to do in this book is also talk about my own participation in those kind of things. And, a lot of what I wanted to do with this book was certainly tell the honest, true story about what happened in the White House, but also kind of my personal journey as a part of that. And part of that was kind of peeling back the curtain on certain aspects of my character that I had never really had to wrestle with, because I had never had that kind of proximity to power and had never been in quite an environment like that. And it revealed a lot about me. And so I certainly don't hold myself above the fray in this. When I say vipers, I was one of them a lot of times.
I should note, before we dive into the substance of the book, that it has drawn an expectedly intense reaction from the White House. This morning, President Trump tweeted, quote, a low-level staffer that I hardly knew named Cliff Sims wrote yet another boring book based on made-up stories and fiction. He pretended to be an insider when in fact he was nothing more than a gopher. He signed a non-disclosure agreement. He is a mess, unquote. Now, you were on New Day on CNN when this tweet was published.
I was
and literally air, yeah. Responded, there it is. So I'm guessing you saw this coming.
Well, there's no doubt, we've seen this, all of us kind of as observers have seen this happen over time. And, a lot of the people that were in that White House at various times when they left under what other circumstances were, they were diminished in different ways and said that they were a nobody or played a very small role or whatever it may be. And it really just doesn't bother me one bit, I think, in one respect, because it's kind of predictable. You kind of know that it's coming. But I also said on the air this morning that I think one of the things that's important to me is I realize when I come to D.C. that everyone there seems to be caught up in what their job is and who they work for and their proximity to whatever powerful person or whatever. And I just never wanted my identity to be wrapped up in that. And it sometimes it was. Mm-hmm. But now it just doesn't really matter to me what anybody, Donald Trump or anyone else, has to say about me. I'm very comfortable with who I am.
One thing that's being said that may have a little more of an impact is coming from Michael Glassner, who was the CEO for the president's re-election campaign. He tweeted today that the campaign is preparing to sue you for violating the non-disclosure agreement the president referred to. One of our listeners, Som Records, asks, ask him about the non-disclosure agreement. Who had to sign them? How was it presented to him? And did anyone in the White House take it seriously? Did you sign a non-disclosure agreement?
Yeah, the fact is I really just don't remember. And I kind of like assume that whatever onboarding paperwork that, you know, Sean Spicer, who wrote a book, or Corey Lewandowski and Dave Bossi on the campaign, who wrote books, you know, whatever everyone else signed, I assume that I did that as a part of whatever the onboarding paperwork was.
Wait a minute. You joined a campaign and signed paper. Why would you sign paperwork that you did not read?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people out there could probably be could sympathize with your start a new job, whatever it may be, and they just pile a mountain of paperwork in front of you and you just go to town, you know, signing on to get on board or whatever.
I'm sorry,
it is.
But as a broadcaster, as someone who says he's got some experience in broadcasting from Alabama, you must have already known the importance of the way that you deal with information in any kind of communication role. There are certain things I'm not allowed to disclose. As the host of 1A, sure. I work for a station that's owned by a university sure. in partnership with NPR. So because of the line of work I'm in, I know there are certain things I will never discuss with the public because they are privileged because of my job. You really want me to believe that you signed a non-disclosure agreement with no idea what it was? Really?
Well, what I'm saying is I don't remember if I did or not. That's the point. That's the point. It's not talking about the specific paperwork, whatever it was. I'm telling you, I don't remember if I did. And ultimately, you know, whatever. I haven't seen any legal notice or anything like that. There's been some people tweeting, and until there's more substance to it than that, I don't really have much to add.
All right. Well, then let's dive into the book. On page 31, you write, in my view, this really was the Flight 93 election. Charge the cockpit or you die. That, of course, is a reference to United Flight 93, which was bound for San Francisco but crashed in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania on 9/11 after the passengers rushed the terrorists. What did you mean by that? The Flight 93 election, sure. Charge the cockpit or die.
So those aren't my words. Those are the words of a guy named Michael Anton, who worked in the White House and the National Security Council. But at the back during the campaign, he wrote this pseudonymous essay about the way he viewed the election. And it was basically the reference there is, listen, we realized that the plane is hijacked. And so people made a decision that, you know what, if we don't do anything, we're going to crash. And if we do something, maybe there's a chance that we survive. And maybe there's not. And so they made a decision to take action. And he used that analogy to kind of paint the picture of the way he viewed the Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton election, that he said, you know, there's a lot of uncertainties with Donald Trump. You know, we didn't know what we were going to get. I do know what I'm going to get with Hillary Clinton, and I think it's going to be very negative. And so let's take our chances here. And so I referenced that in terms of me making a decision about whether or not I wanted to go and take a leave of absence as CEO of my company to go and work on the campaign for the last couple of months. And I wrestled with that decision and ultimately, like many other conservatives out there, decided that it really was a binary choice. It was going to be Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. I knew what I was going to get with Hillary Clinton. I didn't like it. I was not quite sure what I was going to get with Donald Trump, but I was willing to take a chance on that. And so that was kind of part of my decision-making process of joining the campaign.
Now, you mentioned just now leaving your company. You were the founder of Yellowhammer Media, which gave you a little experience dealing with press and media to become the director of message strategy for the White House. There was a recent write-up about your book in The Atlantic that referred to you as, according to The Atlantic's author, the improbable wallflower of the West Wing. And you ended up in a lot of meetings with a lot of high-profile people. That must have been, for a former journalist, kind of like catnip. You are a person who is skilled in recalling true events, and now you're in the room where it happens with lots of interesting happening people.
Yeah, well, it was fascinating. You know, one of my jobs early on in the administration was to be in a lot of these meetings and in anticipation of potentially getting press calls about them. And I was more or less kind of a fact checker. That if somebody called and said, you know, hey, we hear that Donald Trump said X, Y, Z in this meeting with the president of Egypt or whoever it may be, you know, internally, I could say, no, that's not true. Or, well, there's a thread of truth there, but it's out of context. Or, yes, that is what happened. And then the press team could kind of formulate a way to respond to that. I didn't really realize it at the time, not until I left and started thinking about writing this book and started working on it. Didn't realize how my kind of the journalistic aspect of observation and being able to paint a picture and the details and just the memory of different things, how important of an aspect that would be of my book. But one of the things I'm most proud of is a lot of people that have written about the book have noted that kind of aspect of it, that there are a lot of details that I'm not just telling you what happens. I'm going to show you what happened, and I'm going to paint a picture for you and really put you in the room. And I laughed at that when The Atlantic wrote that, the kind of improbable wallflower, but that is kind of what it was. I was in the room for a lot of these meetings on a wide range of topics and just got to observe, you know, the most powerful people in the world making decisions, the way that they interact with each other. And it was really, really just an extraordinary experience. And so I try to relay that experience to others through this book.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
NPR's Code Switch tackles race and identity in America with humanity and humor. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll get uncomfortable. It's worth it. Find Code Switch on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let me get to a few questions and comments from our listeners. Box Brown tweeted, I would like to know why he took a job in the Trump administration. What made you decide to join the administration after the campaign?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it really came down to, you know, my wife and I talked a lot about it and the pros and cons of that. And ultimately, we realized that not a lot of people get this opportunity. Not a lot of people are offered the chance to work in the White House. And I worked in the West Wing, so an even smaller number of people. And we realized that if we didn't take that opportunity, that once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, that we would really never, ever be able to say again, you know, well, we really wish that there was somebody in there who represented our values or represented what we believe. And so I wanted to take that opportunity to do that and be a voice in the room for the things that I believed.
So maybe that was the biggest pro. What was the biggest con as you were thinking about whether to join the White House?
Well, I had built a business. I'd spent the previous 5 or 6 years building a company from scratch and building it up and really trying to grow it and loved doing it, loved the work that I was doing. We had a great life in Birmingham, Alabama with a beautiful house and, you know, we were doing it. It was just great. We had a lot of time to spend together as a family and that kind of thing. And so when you move to D.C., the cost of living goes through the roof, of course, and I had to sell my company probably at a pretty steep discount to take that job. And spend a lot of time away from my family. But it was worth it. I'd do it again in a heartbeat.
A lot of skepticism we're getting from some of our listeners about just the nature of this. And to be fair, lots of the tell-all books that have come out of the Trump administration. Will writes, I'm not sure if the 7th book that says the same thing can be considered jaw-dropping. Glenn agreed. Right. Glenn asks, how is this any different than any other quote-unquote tell-all book by someone who clearly accepted a job and received a paycheck from taxpayers with an intent to make some money after writing a book? Cliff?
Well, one of the things I realized as I was approaching the possibility of writing this book, and I'd never really thought about doing it until I left, but I realized that pretty much every book that has been written about this White House has either come from the perspective I'm going to burn the place down, and frankly, I've read some of those, and they make up some stuff in those books that just I was there and it wasn't true. And on the other hand, you kind of have the more sycophantic books that are painted as the greatest thing that ever happened. And my goal was to tell the true story, the good, which some of the good I think will really surprise some of the president's critics. The bad, some of the bad is maybe with more specificity and with a firsthand look at that in a way that journalists aren't able to because they're always reliant on these sources. I mean, Bob Woodward's book, for instance, is such a big bestseller. Well, as hard as Bob Woodward may work to get it right, he's ultimately reliant on these sources, a lot of them who are unnamed, and the readers are left wondering, you know, who are these people and what is their perspective or their axe to grind or whatever it may be. And with me, you have someone who is an insider who's willing to give you the truth about everything, including myself, good, bad, and otherwise, and is putting my name on it as a firsthand account. And I think all of those things combined make this a unique offering in this space.
Now, the book's been getting a lot of buzz, much of which focuses on some of its anecdotes. You quote General John Kelly, the chief of staff, calling his job the worst blanking job I ever had. You call Kellyanne Conway a cartoon villain and compare her to Cruella de Vil. You talk about inadvertently seeing her text leaks to, in your words, 14 different reporters at once. You also talk about President Trump screaming at House Speaker, former House Speaker Paul Ryan, saying, quote, "I remember being in Wisconsin and your own people were booing you. You were out there dying like a dog, Paul, like a dog. And what I do, I saved your..." But he doesn't say but in the book. Do you have any hesitation about recounting any of this? I mean, is there any stuff that you decided was too hot to print or anything you felt like keeping out?
Well, the what I tried to do was every illustration that I tell, I hope can make a larger point. And so when you spend, you know, 500 days in a place where literally every single thing that happens is newsworthy and, you know, everything you do plays out on television screens around the world, I mean, you couldn't pack it all into one book. And so what I try to do, especially with the president, is the anecdotes that I tell, I try to do them in a way that helps people understand a larger point about the way he operates, the way he ticks. And so you can get inside of his head, even when he's making decisions or doing things, you're like, I can't make sense of that. Like, why in the world would you do that? Or, you know, whatever it may be, that maybe you can at least understand his perspective and when he's coming from, even when you disagree.
Chad tweeted, "What is Cliff's biggest regret from his time in the White House?"
Oh, that's an easy one, actually. And I talk about this in the book. You know, I got so caught up in the job sometimes in terms of like the power struggle and the internal machinations and who's up and who's down and how can I position myself to get ahead and all of the stuff that comes along with that, that I really feel like there were times where I lost perspective on what was important and was not a picture of my faith and the type of person and the man of character and integrity that I would hope to present to the people around me and my colleagues, and I regret a lot of that.
With regards to your faith, we did get some questions about how that intersected with your work in the Trump administration. Nikki tweeted, "Please ask him, as a Christian, has he ever seen evidence of Trump actually acting Christ-like? If yes is the answer, he must give examples or take a hike." We don't want you to take a hike, Cliff, but we'll give you a minute to think about that. We'll continue with Cliff Sims, former director of White House Message Strategy and author of the new book, Team of Vipers. We'll get some more of your questions, too. Stay close.
In the Trump era, the news moves faster than ever, and the NPR Politics podcast is here to keep you informed. Every time there's a major political story, we get our best correspondents together to sort through the noise. The NPR Politics podcast, what you need to know right when it happens.
Back now to our conversation with Cliff Sims, author of the new book, Team of Vipers. One of the things you note in the book is that you're not particularly fond of leakers. You recount seeing Kellyanne Conway leaking information to reporters and then write, quote, "The staff-on-staff backstabbing was a distraction and contributed to the toxic work environment," unquote. With that in mind, you wrote a book. And according to NPR News, you got a seven-figure publishing deal. Is that not a little hypocritical?
Well, I put my name on it. I think that's one of the main differences. A lot of these leakers in the White House, it's always anonymous sources say this, that, and the other. And so I was willing to put my name on mine. So I think that's one of the big differences there.
But you're still sharing information about privileged conversations that happened behind closed doors among people who had no expectation that they would ever be made public.
Yeah, but I think ultimately I felt like that the American people need to know, have a right to know the truth about what's going on in this White House, especially one that is the most talked about ever. I mean, it's really hard to wade through what's true and not true. There's so many salacious things that come out of there that are always based on these kind of anonymous yada, yada, yada. And so I felt like it was important. This is an important offering, hopefully, for the historical record of the truth about what was going on in the People's House at one of the most fascinating times in American history.
You also write in the book, among other things, you write, quote, "I learned something important from the president, something that I have tried to make a core operating principle in my life. You have to make peace with being misunderstood," unquote.
Ooh, yeah.
Amen to that, as somebody who works in the public eye. I think it's definitely right. True. Is there any particular misunderstanding from your perspective about President Trump that you wish people saw differently?
Well, I think sometimes people attach nefarious intent to a lot of the things he does when he doesn't have nefarious intent or... you know, I'll just use the example that I use in the book. You know, what made me think about this was, you know, the president promised that he was going to move the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And multiple presidents before him had promised to do that and didn't do it. And he did. And right after he made the announcement that he was going to do that, we walk back over to the outer oval, just outside the Oval Office, and there's a TV on the wall there. And it's showing the unrest in the Middle East. And you can see, you know, rioting. People are burning him in effigy. They're shooting at his picture and, you know, all the things that go along with that. And I watched him kind of take that in. And my instinct in that moment was kind of similar, honestly, to the way I feel when I see someone on the sidewalk trip. I want to look away because when they look up to see if anyone saw it, I don't want them to be embarrassed. And Trump's reaction, though, was really interesting to me because he just said, you know, how widespread is this? And I said, you know, I don't know. It's hard to tell. They picked the hot spots. And he just kind of said, well, what's next? What are we doing next today? And it stuck with me because to be able to do anything in life of that magnitude or even in our lives, you know, we're never going to be the president of the United States, but we make big decisions in our lives and go for things, make decisions where we're going to go for something or not. And a lot of time what stops us from doing that is fear about what other people are going to say or think about us. And you had a whole segment of the world who thought that Trump was just the most evil person in history. And he was willing to just let that kind of roll off him like water off of a duck's back. And I think that that's a good lesson for everybody.
Is that a little different, though, when you're an elected official? I mean, I'm hired by one entity, and so I have a little bit more leeway for what I say and do to an extent. But as the president, you're accountable to 300 million people plus. It kind of matters what those 300 million people say and think about you, doesn't it?
Sure, sure. But I just think that the reason why Donald Trump has been able to do some things that other people probably wouldn't have been able to pull off because he just was willing to endure the criticism longer than anybody else was. And that doesn't mean all those decisions that he makes are right. And you're right. You know, he'll get held accountable one way or the other. In 2020, people get to make a decision on what they think about that stuff. But I do think that that is a rare trait in a politician, a seemingly just unending willingness to endure criticism. And I think he deserves credit for sticking to his guns on some of that stuff sometimes.
How would you compare Donald Trump's willingness to endure criticism about his policies to, say, Barack Obama's willingness to endure criticism about being an American?
I'm not sure I'm following you there.
Every president endures criticism. Is Donald right. Trump's endurance special?
I don't know. I guess I've never been around another president. You know, I've never seen it that up close and personal. 100% anybody who rises to that level. I mean, good grief. I mean, just the President Obama, the things that they endured, the criticism that he endured. I think it takes a special person to be willing to take on that. Anybody who's going to say, I think I should be president of the United States has got some thick skin. So I don't know if Donald Trump is unique in that way. He's just the only president I've been up close and personal and seen.
Let me get to a few more listener comments. Love Legislation tweets, how can Trump have people sign NDAs when they're working in public service? I find this appalling, like a banana republic dictator, not to mention what it says about the person forcing you to do it. Karen writes, tying yourself in with flawed and selfish politicians from either party is a familiar story. Haven't we heard this tale before, and would we hear it at all if he hadn't been forced into leaving? Melissa writes, "It's hard to respect the people who claim to cling to their Christianity when this administration has done everything possible to discount the teachings of Jesus. These Christians of convenience ignore the greatest commandment and use religion as an excuse for their own prejudices and behaviors." Talk about that, because you write about that in the book very early on. You talk about being raised a devout Christian. Your father and grandfather were both Baptist ministers. And you write that you were more ideologically connected to Ted Cruz and more aspirationally connected to Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Ted Cruz, of course, from Texas. In light of your faith, how did you reconcile that with regard to supporting Donald Trump?
It's a great question, a totally fair question. You know, my wife and I talked a lot about this back during the campaign. And I'll never forget a trip that I took to Egypt. And I talk a little bit about it in the book. And I have a lot of friends in Egypt, Christian friends in Egypt, who are enduring, you know, persecution, the likes of which that those of us who live in America could not even fathom. And one of the things that struck me about one of them is that they had a campaign sign for el-Sisi in their house. And I said,
Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, the current president of Egypt.
That's right. And I was like, well, help me make sense of this. And she said, well, you know, when Mubarak was president, you know, they were dragging our people through the streets. They were bombing our churches. And Sisi said that he wasn't going to let them do that anymore. And we just want to be able to live in peace. And it was kind of an eye-opening experience for me, because clearly could not be any more different. You have a fundamentalist Muslim president, certainly not a great friend of Christians, but someone who's just basically saying, well, I'm going to let them live their lives. And so this person thought, you know what, I'm going to go and campaign for this person. And I say all that to say that supporting a politician when it's a binary choice, I mean, there it was, you know, we're going to have Sisi or we're going to have Mubarak or whatever it may be. And in America, you know, it was like we're going to have Donald Trump or we're going to have Hillary Clinton. And when I looked at the policies of the two people, take the personal side out of it, and I know that that's difficult to do, especially with Donald Trump, who's such a giant personality, but the issues that I care about, like who is going to be on the Supreme Court, you know, the religious liberty aspect of the Department of Justice, whether or not they were going to be able to go after the tax-exempt status of faith-based organizations. I mean, go down the list of those things. I think Franklin Graham probably said it better than I ever could. Donald Trump is not a great picture of the Christian faith, but he has at times been a great defender of it in the public square here in the United States. And for that, I think a lot of Christians will be eternally grateful. But I certainly do not look at Donald Trump as someone that I would aspire to live my life like in terms of like how I would want to show my faith to the world.
I'll grant you that. But speaking Christian to Christian, the Bible puts a very high standard on leaders who speak on behalf of the faith. And mm-hmm. Donald Trump is a man who was caught on tape joking about grabbing women by their private parts still won the election. How does that square for you as a Christian?
Well, I hated it. It tore me up and I didn't like it.
And yet you went to work for him. So what does that say about you?
Well, I don't know. Let your listeners decide that.
No, I'm asking you. I mean, as a person of faith who's wrestled with this in the book and publicly, I'm asking you how you think it reflects on you as a Christian that you went to go work for a guy who said he would grab women by their private parts because he's rich.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. As I'm still wrestling with that, and part of the book was kind of is me wrestling with that. But ultimately, you know, every staffer that works for a politician cannot be held to, you know, everything that the person that they work for, it's like your boss. You're not held to everything he does you clearly don't agree with and, you know, whatever. But you ultimately, you do have the decision to make. It's a personal thing. And I wrestled with that when I was in the White House. I talked to my pastor while we were there. Sometimes it's like, hey, what is the point in which you are hurting your own witness by being a part of something, and what things do you just endure or try to be a positive influence where you can? And ultimately, most of the time, I made the decision that that I wanted to be a voice for good where I could behind the scenes. I wanted to use my position there to be a force for good, and I thought I was sometimes, and then sometimes I wasn't.
A few more quick questions I want to get to with you in the time we have left. Yeah, here's a clip from yesterday's White House press conference. This is an exchange between reporter Jordan Fabian of The Hill and Press Secretary Sarah Sanders.
Stephen Miller is quoted in a Cliff Sims book as saying, "I would be happy if not a single refugee foot ever again touched American soil." Is the policy of this administration to eventually get refugee resettlement down to zero?
I'm not aware of any statement like that Stephen Miller has ever made, and certainly not the policy of the administration.
So that was Press Secretary Sarah Sanders answering a question from Jordan Fabian of The Hill. What's your response to that? You talk in the book about feeling that the administration's refugee policy, in your words, lacked nuance and that Stephen Miller was a big reason why.
Well, I think that specific quote from Stephen, I don't think that it was something that he was a policy that he was pursuing. And I actually think that the administration's stated goals on refugees are good. Things like, you know, we want to resettle these people as close that we can to their homes, and we want to prioritize persecuted religious minorities in these parts of the world. Those things are good. I included that quote in the book, though, because I think that it gets at a kind of deeper view of refugees in general that is perhaps pervasive in some parts of the White House, even if it hasn't yet manifested itself completely in the on the policy side. Mm-hmm. But that issue is one that's really important to me because I've been to the Middle East and spent a lot of time working with Syrian refugees. And so when we talked about that in the White House, I saw the faces of those kids and those parents and those people that have been displaced. And the point in that conversation, what made that comment or Stephen's response to me was in response to me coming up and basically saying, hey, I'm looking at our numbers here on the number of Syrian Christian refugees that we have been taking in, and it's way below what we promised. And this the president promised to help religiously persecuted minorities in that part of the world. I just mm-hmm. want him to keep that promise. And so that was Stephen's response.
Speaking of Stephen's, Andrew emailed, what criteria made up the enemies list and why did a comedian, Stephen Colbert, rank so high? You were on the Late Show last night where you joked that Colbert was only second on the list.
Yeah. Colbert wasn't on the list. That was a joke. Yeah, it was a time in the White House when the president was seeing a lot of these anonymous quotes in articles that were not just saying negative things about whatever. They were saying negative things about him, and it was White House staff. You know, senior White House official says Donald Trump, blah, blah, blah. And he's basically saying, who are these people? And my take on that in the moment was, the same people that bailed on you in the campaign, that quit on you then, a lot of those people are here in the White House now, and they're quitting on you again. And so I told him who I thought some of those people were. And so that's kind of how that happened. And again, this is another kind of moment in the White House where I, in retrospect, realized, like, man, I'm just so caught up in this and really the selfishness involved in going after your colleagues in that way.
When you were eventually let go, or your book makes the argument that you were pushed out, you were told you did not have security clearance, that it had never been activated. That's true, and you had a bunch of face-to-face access with the president, literally within striking distance with no security clearance, or it's not true and they lied to you. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. The good news is that there are dozens upon dozens of pictures online of me in meetings, in all these meetings, so they can't deny that I was there. Ultimately, I don't really know what to make of that. Anybody who knows anything about the background check or the security clearance process knows that you do a lot of paperwork. There's all these background checks. They call your friends and family, people throughout your lives. And kind of the last step is that they flip a switch that says you have a security clearance now. Mm-hmm. You know, I went through all the beginning parts of that and had no problem with that. It seemed to me that it may have been just an oversight, but it may have, my understanding is it also happened with a lot of others there. And one of the things I talk about in the book, Joshua, is there are other people there that, Rob Porter is a great example. There's a behind the scenes of the Rob Porter scandal where he ultimately had to leave the White House for accusations of domestic abuse and that kind of thing, that he was able to be in one of the closest jobs to the president of the United States with these kind of things in his background.
Right. Staff secretary to the president.
Yeah, it's a very, very powerful, very close job. So there are a lot of issues on the security clearance side, I think, in the administration.
Briefly, Cliff, before we let you go, what is next for you? You mentioned that you sold your business. What's your next step before we go?
Well, hopefully the bestseller list, so we'll start there. But I'm enjoying doing my communications consulting work now, and I really don't know. I'm excited to see what the future holds. We'll find out.
If the president asked you to return, would you do it?
I don't think so. You know, I've had my my fill of politics for now, so I want to try to go and expand my horizons in other areas.
Cliff Sims, former director of White House message strategy under President Trump. His new book is called Team of Vipers, My 500 Extraordinary Days in the Trump White House. You can read an excerpt online at the1a.org. Cliff, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This conversation was produced by Paige Osborne and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.